May it please the court, my name is Tara Lee. I represent the plaintiffs who are human rights victims in Somalia. They brought suit under the Torture Victim Protections Act and the Alien Tort Claims Act. In this case, the defendant Muhammad Ali Samatar was individually responsible for the widespread systematic use of torture and extrajudicial killing by summary execution at firing squads against the civilian Isak clan population of the northern region of Somalia. This is not a case about disproportionate or indiscriminate use of force on a battlefield. This is the type of case whose allegations form exactly the causes of action that Congress contemplated when it enacted the Torture Victim Protections Act. The dismissal of this complaint on foreign sovereign immunity grounds creates a rule of law going forward that essentially means any properly pled Torture Victim Protections Act case is going to be dismissed on Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act grounds, absent waiver from some follow-on regime. It means that the officials of the most entrenched and violent regimes in the world are the ones that are going to be immunized going forward. This can't be the rule of law that Congress intended, and we urge you not to affirm that ruling. The first question on consideration of the district court's opinion and in deciding whether or not to affirm the district court's ruling is whether or not this case is a Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act case. In order to resolve that question, the district court had an independent obligation to decide whether or not the defendant had presented a prima facie case that he was a foreign sovereign for the purposes of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. I'm going to couch that question in two parts because there's so many different issues that it implicates. I think it's important to break them down. That question, whether or not we should be under a Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act analysis and whether or not this defendant has satisfied his burden of establishing that we should be there, breaks down into two questions. One, does this individual foreign official defendant qualify as a foreign country for purposes of a Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act consideration? And two, does the particular foreign country in question and the putative government of it, as recognized by the district court in this case, qualify as a foreign state for the purposes of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act analysis? I'd like to take the second question first.
Are either one of those questions jurisdictional issues?
They are, Your Honor. They both are. They both fit within the subject matter jurisdiction issues that the court at the district court level has to decide in order to move forward at all with jurisdiction over the case, because they both go to the question of whether or not the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act applies in the first place.
And so what makes the latter susceptible of judicial determination as opposed to a question of executive determination with respect to the laws of diplomacy? And you can reach that if you want to reach that now, that's fine. If you have an order in which you would prefer to reach that and factor it in, that's fine too.
I'm happy to take it now, Your Honor. The reason that the second question, whether or not the particular foreign country and the putative government as recognized by the district court should qualify as a foreign state, are jurisdictional questions within judicial purview, because there is a long line of case law where we resolved these issues in the United States court system long before we had a Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, and we did so in varying different theories of immunity that involved oftentimes, but not in every circumstance, the weighing in by the State Department or the executive branch. Now, the proper balance there is that the district court should defer in matters of foreign policy and on these types of questions to the opinion of the executive, and that's what the long history of case law does. We have a shift in the history of the case law that takes place around 1950 and inserts a sort of restrictive view of immunity. And a lot of those cases are discussed in our briefs, and we could go on at length about them. But the key and important detail of all the case law when it's taken together is that political recognition of a government is an exclusive function of the executive branch. In this case, our executive branch did not speak. The Department of State did not weigh in, and that should have been.
And that creates a vacuum that we're entitled to evade. Invade, rather.
I wouldn't characterize it that way, Your Honor. I would say that that demonstrates a considered and purposeful silence on the issue that should be respected by the district court. I would suggest, in response to your question, Your Honor, that you are exactly right, that the executive is the proper person to go recognizing governments. Recognition carries with it an acknowledgement by our country that that government has territorial control over the region it purports to control. It's the last thing we want judges at the district court level doing, particularly in the absence of State Department input. So what we have now, because of that ruling and because this district court reached into the executive's purview and took that role, what we have now is the exact thing the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and all of the foreign sovereign immunity cases intend to avoid.
Now, I have a little bit of trouble with that characterization, and I don't mean to bog you down here, but the record certainly reflects that there are quite a few lines of diplomatic engagement between the United States and Somalia, and there is the traditional distinction between successions of states and succession of governments. But it's hard for me to understand your characterization that the district court usurped that function. It seemed to me that it simply recognized the diplomatic reality that the government does have forms of relationships with the Somali government and has traditionally throughout its troubled existence.
The reason I put it that way, Your Honor, is that diplomatic recognition carries with it a particular impact in the conduct of foreign relations, and that's the reason we reserve it to the executive. I'll give it to you in sort of a hypothetical way. We know that the State Department chose to be silent, that it was a considered and purposeful silence. We know that there are various groups trying to assert control in that region, and that the United States, it's not too much of an extrapolation to imagine, has some foreign policy interests in coming and going in that region of the country these days. Now, if the State Department chose not to diplomatically recognize the TFG, if the State Department chose not to defer to the letters from the TFG and let it stand and let it go forward, then for the judge to reach in and recognize the TFG and declare in writing that those letters get deference over the letters of another government that has de facto control, that's where I think the district court inserted itself into the executive role improperly.
But you're having us read into it. It's possible to construe the State Department silence in a variety of ways. They may be just as perplexed about this as we are. But you're asking us to form our own opinions with respect to the absence of a statement of interest. And that seems to me a very dangerous path.
I agree with you, Your Honor. I think it would be just as dangerous at the circuit court level as at the district court level. I don't think it's necessary at all, because I don't think, and I would argue to you strongly and supported by case law and precedent and the proper policy considerations, that we're not talking about a Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act analysis at all. When we're discussing this particular country and whether or not the foreign state qualifies for Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act analysis, the important rubric to consider that in is, say you are within the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act analysis and you're talking about whether or not Torture Victim Protection Act claims can go forward. This ruling limits you to the existing exceptions in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, and the only ones that could possibly apply in the human rights context are a waiver by a succession government or a state-sponsored terror exception. Now, when you're talking about a state that is not doesn't have a recognized government for our diplomatic bodies to engage with, for our State Department to recognize, and for our executive to negotiate with, in this circumstance, you don't have an entity that has the capacity to provide a waiver, and you don't have an entity that could be designated as a state sponsor. So it's for that reason that I think in this case, it's particularly problematic to have launched into the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act analysis and to be weighing the exceptions at all.
Are you agreeing that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act pertains to the individuals who are acting in official capacity for the government at the time the act's committed?
I'm not, Your Honor. I know that there is a case law split on that question, and I would suggest to this court that the Seventh Circuit position in Enoharo is a very well-reasoned treatment of that. It came out in 2005. And it finds that individuals are not within the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act rubric at all.
Well, if that's your position, I don't understand why you're worrying about what the exceptions are in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
I'm not, Your Honor. And what I couched it as in the beginning as the question of whether or not the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act applies at all is a two-part question. First, the individual has to be a foreign official defendant who qualifies as a foreign country for purposes of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. I don't think he does because, number one, individuals, I would argue, are not within the intended rubric of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act at all. I think the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is very clearly and by its language designated to foreign states. There is an existing common law immunities that history in our country that the United States government has argued applies properly to individuals. In both the statement of interest that the government submitted in the Mata versus Dichter case and in an amicus brief in the Second Circuit in the Kensington case, the U.S. government lays forth a very compelling outline of why the government's position is that individuals are not even covered in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
Inconsistent positions handed over history as to whether or not individuals are covered by the FSIA.
The government has done so in individual cases by weighing in with sort of suggestions of immunity and suggestions of interest. And part of the reason we have a Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is because Congress tried very hard to codify what was an existing common law scheme and to make the decisions be more consistent.
Okay, so one position is that the language of the Act does not encompass individuals. What about as a practical matter? Obviously, the argument's made that states can only act through individuals, that if you don't give immunity to the individual, you're effectively denying it immunity to the state.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond to that?
I respond by pointing out to the court what is, I think, the core and most important thing I would like to leave the court with today. And that's that certain acts are never sovereign acts. Certain acts do not qualify for consideration.
You're saying torture is not a sovereign act.
That's what I'm saying, Your Honor. Torture and extrajudicial killing. Those are not acts that can be officially endorsed by any country, that can be ratified by any country and qualify as an official act for purposes of invoking an immunity. The question that we ought to be looking at, and that I think some of the cases have touched upon, is whether or not the individual in question, whether the conduct that's being considered is properly attributable to the state. Torture and extrajudicial killing are never properly attributable as official sovereign acts. And so I think that the first question for the district court should be whether or not the acts in question are official, acts within the scope of authority of any foreign official, such that they could be considered to be acts that warrant qualification as acting on behalf of your state.
So you don't even have us getting necessarily to the question of whether an individual can qualify for immunity under the FSIA. You're asking for a narrower construction that your assertion is that because a state cannot authorize torture, you need not even get to the umbrella conclusion that the Seventh Circuit has reached.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think in this case in particular, you needn't revisit the issue of whether or not individuals qualify under Foreign Sovereign Immunities Acts. You needn't look in particular at whether this particular foreign state qualifies under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. The rule of law that these cases are begging for is the clear understanding of how the issues interplay with each other. And it's as follows. First, the analysis is whether or not the activities, the acts in question, can be official acts of any state. And there's a long history of case law recognizing, internationally and domestically, that torture and extrajudicial killing cannot. Then we have a statutory scheme created by our Congress that's empowered in our Constitution to decide which violations of the law of nations can have enforcement mechanisms in our domestic courts in the United States. And we have a statutory scheme that clearly recognizes that principle as well. We have a statute that was passed for the purpose of creating a cause of action for torture and extrajudicial killing.
It seems to me your argument is all you need is the Alien Tort Claims Act.
You know why you need both, Your Honor? Because the Alien Tort Claims Act is for aliens. And when the Torture Victim Protections Act was passed, Congress said, well, now this is crazy. You can be an alien and bring these suits in our country, and our own citizens can't. And so they expanded what was the existing common law status of these kinds of cases going forward, and they did so specifically and explicitly recognizing that individuals who are foreign officials of other governments are going to be called into this courtroom and held accountable if they have chosen to reside in the United States and avail themselves of the freedoms of this country. They're going to be subject to the jurisdiction of these courts.
So you're saying the Torture Victim Protection Act was to allow Americans?
It's in the legislative history, Your Honor.
What's the language say?
Does the language have
that limitation?
The language includes United States citizens. I believe it also extends to aliens, but the Alien Tort Claims Act already had that jurisdiction in place for aliens to bring the causes of action based on the violation of the law of nations.
Does the interpretation just sort of have the Torture Victim Protection Act subsuming the Alien Tort Claims Act?
It doesn't subsume it, Your Honor. What it does, the way that the United States Supreme Court has described it, is that the Torture Victim Protections Act was a supplement to Filardiga and the Alien Tort Claims Act, and that together they create the statutory scheme that Congress intended. And that's a statutory scheme that's in place so that these exact type of allegations, these types of torture and extrajudicial killings, we're talking about things that are not close calls. These are not battlefield discriminate force decisions. These are firing squads that go door to door, pull people from their homes, and shoot them.
We have a limited amount of time. So let me ask you one more question for you. Mm-hmm. Before you explain as briefly as you can how Dole helps you in this case.
It does, Your Honor. Dolefords v. Patrickson is a very well-reasoned consideration of the question of former officials and the status of an entity and when you measure that status for purposes of being within the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
For purposes of the existence of removal jurisdiction.
In that case, it was, Your Honor. But what Dole Food versus Patterson does is look specifically first at the language of the statute itself and note that it's in present tense. But what it also does is it talks about subject matter jurisdiction and how what we're talking about in this case is a status-based jurisdictional question, not a conduct-based immunity, which might carry with you later for very good reasons, when we have immunities that we want to protect conduct. What Dole Food versus Patterson does a very good job of and analyzes, I think, correctly, is that a subject matter jurisdiction bar, the one that says plaintiffs can't come through the door to this courtroom at all, that kind of bar is a status-based bar, and that it should attach to the status at time of suit. And that's how status jurisdictional issues have historically been resolved.
And where you're saying Dole controls this thing? Former official?
If we were then...
You look at it at the time. Yeah. What's the timing? You look at the time the...
At the time of the filing...
The time of the filing.
The status as of the time of the filing of suit. That's the rule in Dole Foods. And I think it's controlling...
That applies to your control.
If you get to a Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act analysis, if you decide that what you have is an individual whose acts were within the scope of his authority and that you decide that individuals fit within the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, then Dole controls.
You can't say that Dole controls. You can say that because the language of Dole is limited to 1603B2 and the focus of the Supreme Court's decision is very clearly on the use of the present tense in that provision which deals with instrumentalities, which isn't applicable here. You can certainly argue, I think, credibly, that the rationale that you're advancing, that is, that the status of the action to which the immunity would attach by analogy here would be the status of the actor at the time that suit is brought.
But it's probably better to say that the analysis pertains and applies and that the reasoning is sound and should be applied in this case.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Lee. You have some time reserved. Let's hear from Mr. Goldberg.
Good morning. May it please the court. First thing I wanted to say is that today, for the first time, we heard the statement that Mr. Samantar was individually responsible for indiscriminate killing and some of these activities. Up until now, all the pleadings have him in his official capacity as Prime Minister, Minister of Justice, and so forth. So I think that that is...
Which would make him an instrumentality.
Correct. And it's inflammatory and is inappropriate for that language to be used here, just as a basis. Now I'll return to what I was going to say before. You asked a question about jurisdictional, whether the jurisdictional issues could be raised with regard to the status of Somalia. And the answer is no, they can't, because they weren't raised at the district court level.
Issues can't be raised. Subject matter jurisdiction can't
Well, lack of jurisdiction can't be waived, but the presence, and I'll give you several cases in which the reverse is not the case. It's always appropriate to raise the issue of lack of subject matter jurisdiction to this court, whether it was raised prior at the district court level or not. But the reverse is not the case. In the Belhaus case, for example, which we cite, but the appeal of that was affirmed after our brief was submitted. In that case, the court held that there was a lack of subject matter jurisdiction, basically on the same set of issues we're here today on. And they raised on appeal for the first time that the FSAI did not apply to a foreign official after he left office, and that the FSAI did not apply because the lawsuit was filed against an individual and not against the sovereign. Those were two issues to try to present jurisdiction where the court had ruled earlier that it did not have jurisdiction. These were raised for the first time in appeal, and the court held that they would not even address them because they were waived by not having been brought to the district court level. I could point out two other cases, Linares versus the U.S. Department of Justice, a Seventh Circuit case, 2 Fed 3rd, 208, and an unpublished opinion, Munn versus Michigan, a Sixth Circuit case, Michigan National Bank, rather, 993 F. 2nd, 1547. In each of those cases, the issue of jurisdiction where the court had ruled it had no jurisdiction was raised for the first time on appeal. In each of those cases, the court said it couldn't address those because they weren't raised at the district court level.
It would not address the question of subject matter jurisdiction.
They would not address the presence of subject matter jurisdiction where they had ruled there had no jurisdiction earlier. Courts will always address the issue of lack of subject matter jurisdiction if it hadn't been raised before, but the reverse is not the same. And I specifically would refer you to the appeal in Belhaus versus Ya'alon, 515 F3rd, 1279, which is remarkably similar and in several ways. If the court does believe that the issue of Somalia status could be addressed, then we get to the point that what is it that the court would determine as to whether or not to include Somalia under the FSIA. And we would argue that the State Department, listed as an independent state, the United States never severed relationships with, severed recognition of Somalia. We do have a special envoy appointed to Somalia, and we do have direct communications with the transitional federal government. Those are all the indicia that the State Department would use to recognize a state, and they're a member of the United Nations also.
Well, Ms. Lee says that we can, or suggests that we can decide this, I think, much more narrowly by concluding that torture can never be an official act.
That has been addressed by many courts, and the finding is pretty much the same in that all states indicate that torture is not an official act, and yet things happen within their jurisdiction that that they, although would not be official acts, would not be the policy of the state, they recognize as having occurred and are participated in during the official or on behalf of the sovereign.
But what we have is a statute that is created because of a concern about affording some remedy to the victims of extraterritorial torture. So it appears to constitute congressional recognition of the fact that torture is impermissible and remediable. And the question is just the relationship between that statute and the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And the appellant's argument, as I understand it, is that statute constitutes recognition of the broader humanitarian principle that torture cannot be officially sanctioned. It's not just a free-floating diplomatic recognition of it. It's a statutory embodiment of the fact that it can't be recognized or protected. And that takes it out of the purview of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities.
Courts have been dealing with this. District courts have been dealing with this, and appellate courts have been dealing with this issue all around the United States. And by and large, they find that if the FSIA, if Congress meant to include an exception for what's called jus cogens, I believe is how it's pronounced, kind of behavior, that it should have been part of the FSIA. The FSIA has been amended since it was originally passed in 76. It was amended in 96 to include state sponsors of terrorism.
And the courts around the country that you refer to are the cases cited by the district court in her opinion?
That's correct. And there are others. One court, the Siderman case, specifically said that it is doubtful that any state has ever violated jus cogens norms rivaling that of the Third Reich, but even violations of that magnitude did not create an exception to the FSIA where Congress has not created one. It's a congressional determination.
Well, the question here, though, is that Congress has what we're addressing is the situation in which it is at least arguable that Congress has created one.
We don't see that exception in the FSIA. So they're arguing that international norm would supersede the FSIA in essence.
No, we're asking whether the Torture Victims Protection Act qualifies the FSIA.
I don't think that you could read it that way. I think that the FSIA and specifically said that to avoid liability by invoking the FSIA, a former official would have to prove an agency relationship to a state which would require that the state admit some knowledge or authorization of the relevant acts, and that's part of the legal history, the legislative history of the TVPA.
Is there any language in the FSIA that would rely on to show that the FSIA applies to individuals as opposed to countries?
Well, I think Your Honor quoted earlier that countries can't act but through their organs, instrumentalities, and people. Courts have found that time and again. Every jurisdiction has found that except the Seventh Circuit.
But there's no language you can point to in the Act that says it would show to us that this Act applies to individuals.
The instrumentality provision.
The instrumentality provision would be the most.
That's what you would rely on.
That's the most appropriate, I would believe, yeah.
Agency or instrumentality of a foreign state means a separate legal person, corporate or otherwise.
Right.
And that's what they rely on.
Exactly.
And is an organ of the state and is neither a citizen of the state as defined in 1332C, which is the section dealing with corporations. So if you're going to be an agency or instrumentality, I believe you're going to have to be a corporation or a partnership or a joint venture or some type of entity. Because of you have to meet all three of these requirements. Well, I don't want you to get bogged down on that.
Yeah, I can tell you that the citations that we gave in the brief covered that issue pretty extensively, and most courts have held that individuals are.
You're right about that. My question is,
maybe they're all wrong. I think
how
that's
you
what Judge
square that with
them.
We would take the position that they're correct.
We were expecting you to.
What's the impact of the Dole food case here?
I think Dole is not applicable to this case at all. Dole deals with, and they state in the holding that it deals specifically with corporate status at the time to determine standing, pretty much. That it is a question of ownership at the time the case is brought, and it applies to commercial cases. So I think it's really just not applicable. And I think the court went on to say that it wouldn't apply to other types of immunities.
Where did it say that?
I don't have the
that's okay.
Entire Dole case with me, but it's in the holding itself.
You're quite correct that it focuses a great deal of the analysis on the fact that the operative provision, a majority of whose shares is owned by the foreign state, is couched in the present tense. But I did not recall language specifically limiting the focus of the analysis to the
It is there. I don't have the... I don't believe that I kept the whole Dole case with me today.
Please don't take your time looking for it.
You know, there are hundreds of cases that were cited in this.
Did you all argue the Dole case in the district court?
No.
Neither side?
Neither side.
Never came up?
I don't believe so.
Then your brief's here, though.
Yes. I again would focus this court's attention on the logic and reasoning in the Belhaus case and the appeal in the Belhaus case that was affirmed. The case was affirmed by the...
That's that case up in D.C.
Correct.
Well, Israeli general or something?
That's correct. And the...
When was that affirmed?
February 2008.
Yeah, your brief cites the district court.
That's correct. Our brief was submitted prior to... Prior to that, the decision in the Court of Appeals, but the letter from the appellant indicates that it was supplemented. The supplementation letter indicated that it was affirmed.
Right.
And the logic in that is exactly the same as we would say applies in this case. For almost every reason, the situation is similar in that it involves a former officer. It involves the same types of allegations of extrajudicial killing and inhumane behavior.
But didn't it involve what could be characterized as the carrying out of at least quasi-military hostilities in the context of armed conflict? Isn't the distinction here that, at least as the appellant is framing it, is torture against one's own people, pure and simple?
That would be a distinction, and the distinction really is one of in your own territory versus a conflict with another territory. However, the logic is the same. The acts, there was an insurgency campaign. This is not just an act of one person going around and committing these types of activities. This was an anti-insurgency campaign against a secessionist or antagonistic entity, and the level of fighting was quite high. It's not door-to-door. Mr. Samantar is accused of going door-to-door with a rifle and conducting these activities. So in terms of the level...
Or being Minister of Defense and authorizing that particular pattern of conduct.
If he were at that time. The Minister of Defense involves actions against other countries, not security within his own country. And so we would actually argue, if we had to at some point, that this is a misplaced argument altogether. But just the same, he's entitled to the immunity in this country under the FSIA, absent a waiver or any of the other exceptions to the statute that would apply. And it's entirely consistent with the TVPA for Mr. Samantar to be immune.
I mean, if hypothetically we didn't believe that the FSIA provided immunity, are there any other immunities, common law or statutory or otherwise, that are available to your client?
We believe the common law sovereign immunity, head of state immunity would apply for
head of state immunity.
Some of the time when he was first vice president, and acting president from time
first
to time.
First vice president sort of sounds like it's not the head of state to me.
Well, he served as acting president at times during that period also.
But those immunities wouldn't survive his relinquishing of that title, would it?
Probably not.
So that doesn't
probably
help
not.
Him, does it?
Probably not. The common law foreign immunity would apply as well. And the FSIA was meant to codify what had been the common law status of immunity. But
my understanding is that head of state, for example, only immunity only applies during the term. Is that correct? So what would be useful is if there are other immunities that survive departure from office.
Well, just the traditional immunities that we've been honoring since, I guess, 1826 with the Schoonover case, that someone in Mr. Samantar's position, acting as an instrumentality of the state, on behalf of the state, as the TFG acknowledges and at the time, would be immune for those acts absent a waiver of that, which has happened from time to time. It's not an unknown situation where the sovereign says, well, this act is outside the scope, and it's not just for cases where a new regime has taken over, but I believe that there are cases in the Chinese situation where they acknowledge that this activity was outside the scope. We're not going to waive it. That's not the case here. Here, what Mr. Samantar is accused of doing is what he was doing on behalf of the country.
What are we to infer from the fact that the Department of State has failed to file a statement of interest? The appellant suggests that we interpret that as an indication of the fact that its prerogatives in this regard are not at issue.
I don't think it would be fair to infer anything on behalf of either side. State Department went through some transitions during this whole course. Their solicitor was changed. I don't know exactly what, but I don't think it would be appropriate for the court to decide that because the State Department didn't weigh in, the State Department meant it to be one way or the other. There are multiple cases where the State Department has not waived in. I don't know that they've ever taken quite as long not to weigh in before the court decided to activate the case again, but I don't think it would be appropriate. And I don't think that if the court were to look at it, I think that the court, which did in this case, ruled that the TFG, because of the indicia that they did have, was the appropriate authority to waive the immunity. And in this case, they chose not to waive immunity and to provide that coverage, so to speak, for Mr. Samantar. I think it was an appropriate action on that a sovereign has the ability to do, and they took advantage of that, and they did weigh in. And on the other hand, the letters from Somaliland, that's a country that's not recognized by any country. It's not a member of the UN. We have no diplomatic relations with them. It would be the same as a secessionist state here in the United States deciding to form their own government and ignore the United States. Well, that country would not be given the respect that the TFG is given in their attempt to gain control of the country.
Are there any practical problems you can think of that would result if the appellant's position was accepted? That is, that individuals can be sued in the United States for torture, even for acts committed while they were officials of other countries?
Yes. In fact, courts have referred to this problem in many cases where they've said, there's complaints of extraterritorial killing and torture and so forth, and they said from Idi Amin to Mao Zedong, from A to Z, and these courts would be clogged with complaints of claimants who were victims of activities that we found to be unacceptable. And in those courts, they've said that we have to give very clear, precise approval, recognition of what the Congress did in limiting it.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberg. Ms. Lee, you have some time remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to turn first to opposing counsel's discussion of the potential waiver of the foreign state argument here, and remind the court that that's initially a question first of whether the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act applies. That analysis of what arguments were raised before the district court is a question that goes to whether or not the jurisdictional basis of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act applies at all. And I would remind the court and suggest again that the Torture Victim Protection Act and the cases from Filartiga on, starting in 1980, that recognize torture and extrajudicial killing against where the defendants are former officials, that entire line of cases is not restricted by the jurisdictional analysis of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. So the question of waiver, I think, is not necessarily one that's pertinent to the decision that the court has to enter today. The next point that I would want to cover, based on what
let me interrupt you. You're on a roll there, but answer Judge Traxler's question to your opponent, the last at the end. What's the impact of a ruling here if we happen to vacate the district court?
I dispute opposing counsel's suggestion that the courts will be clogged. For one, I would point again to the fact that this is a jurisdictional, or that these statutes apply, the Torture Victim Protections Act and the Alien Tort Claims Act. They're not open to the world. They're open when defendants reside in the United States and subject themselves to the personal jurisdiction of the courts. The legislative history of the Torture Victim Protections Act talks specifically about passing the statutes so this country isn't a safe haven, so that this isn't where you can flee potential retribution in other countries, or when your regime falls, then you can come live in the United States. If you choose to do that, as Defendant Samatar has done, you subject yourself to the civil jurisdiction of the courts. There's no evidence that courts are clogged by these kinds of cases.
If we were to send it back, he could still have an opportunity to try to make another kind of immunity claim? Common law immunity?
One thing that you could do, Your Honor, is remand for further briefing and consideration of the common law immunities issues. I would suggest to the court that I think the case...
Well, he ruled that he didn't have sovereign immunity.
It's the only grounds for the district court's ruling. Nothing else that was before the court was ruled upon. So if there was a remand for consideration of common law immunities, I'm not sure to what counsel refers to with reference to traditional immunities, but of the ones that I'm aware, they were briefed, albeit very briefly, at the district court level and could be resolved here on the facts that are before the court. And those are the head of state immunity and potentially an active state immunity question.
What kind of was the second one?
I think it's couched in the briefs by Defendant Samatar as an official acts immunity. It's
official
very,
acts.
Very briefly. But I assume that we're talking
about...
A head of state immunity, or in what I'm going to call an active state immunity
active
analysis.
State.
And I would suggest that in either of those, this defendant is not going to qualify for immunity.
We don't have to decide that, though.
You don't, Your Honor. But it's, you know, the arguments were raised below. You could remand for further briefing of them, particularly in the active state question. What I would suggest is I think that analysis of an individual foreign official is a more appropriate one in this case than the application of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act for all the reasons that I suggested before. Immunity is an attribute of recognition.
You got a closer question than the one that the Judge Brinkman ruled on.
Well, candidly, I don't think it's close, but I think it's the proper question. I think it's the analysis that Anaharo in the Seventh Circuit would apply to these kinds of situations, and it's the analysis that the U.S. government advocates for individual foreign officials. And I think it's a sound rubric to analyze these types of things. We're not within the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act analysis for this defendant, and we're not within the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act because we have Torture Victim Protection Act allegations, and we have allegations in the complaint that are outside the potential scope of authority of a sovereign act. And where I think the analysis has to begin is with that question. And I want to... The question of whether or not the acts in the complaint are within the scope of authority of the individual defendant. And the reason that I want to that I urge the court to start the analysis there is because every single time that the other circuits that disagree with the Seventh Circuit and do hold that individuals fit within the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, all of those cases, beginning with the Chuidian case in the Ninth Circuit in 1990 and all the cases that follow Chuidian, acknowledge up front that that doesn't apply when the act is outside the scope of authority of the individual foreign defendant. So that should be the first question to decide whether or not you're even in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act analysis. And in this case, when that's the first question, we're looking at torture and extrajudicial killing. Torture is never an official act. the Falardiga case in 1980, I continually point you to because it's sort of the beginning. They talk about the Falardiga case and its progeny when the Supreme Court wrote in Sosa in 2006 about these line of cases. They talk about the Falardiga case and its progeny. And we have as an amicus brief signer in our case, Dolly Falardiga, the plaintiff in that case. She could not have brought her case if the district court ruling in our case were the rule of law going forward.
If we accept your argument, then do we, is the net result that our own officials are now subject to lawsuit here in the United States for with regard to allegations of torture?
The reciprocity question is one that is sort of the elephant in the room about these cases. And I think it's the reason why we have sort of outlier questions or outlier cases. I'm referring to what I call the Bellhouse and Samatar line of cases as sort of outliers. And those cases come from concern about reciprocity. And those cases concern General Yalon in Israel, battlefield decision-making over indiscriminate force. Those types of defendants, whether they be American or Israeli or Somali, an individual general making a single battlefield decision to launch artillery into the foreign sovereign country of Lebanon from the country of Israel, and getting allegations that follow from that accuse that incident of being one of indiscriminate force and the indiscriminate or disproportionate use, is so far afield from what we're talking about in torture and extrajudicial killing.
It's not an extrajudicial killing?
It I think, could be characterized as an extrajudicial killing. It's not the type of extrajudicial killing that's at issue in the Samatar case.
Well, where are you drawing the line then? And what's the authority for the line drawing?
For one thing, the Bellhouse opinion itself and the Dichter opinion are the only two cases I know of that fit that fact pattern, and they both find that the case cannot go forward. So the cases where extrajudicial...
Where do you draw the line between extrajudicial killing and torture for purposes of the position that you're advocating?
Well, torture...
Because it did involve extrajudicial killing.
It did, Your Honor. But what I would suggest is it's a very different question when you're analyzing whether or not it can qualify as an official act, whether it's within the sovereign capacity of a nation.
But your argument, I thought, is whether torture and extrajudicial killing can never be official acts. I thought that was your starting point.
It is my starting point. And let me explain where I think the difference comes, because I think it's key. General Yalon is making a battlefield decision to launch artillery into a foreign country. General Samatar is authorizing an extrajudicial killing that is a mass killing of a civilian population in his country. It is the type of cause of action, an extrajudicial killing of that nature, that has, along with torture, been purposefully made a cause of action in the United States.
But then you're not drawing a line and you're not making a Juice Cogens argument anymore. And I think that's what everyone is trying to wrestle with, that it is apparent that with respect to some hostilities, extrajudicial killing occurs, as it did there. But if you tell us that we have to start with the question of whether the acts are within the scope of the authority, mm-hmm. and then you tell us that torture is never an extrajudicial killing or never within the scope of official authority, that doesn't account for the distinction that you're having us draw now.
Let me explain for a moment where I'm coming from, Your Honor. The torture is never an official act is a specific quote out of Falardiga that applies to torture. Now, the extrajudicial killing distinctions that I'm making are not complicated hair's breadth distinctions. I stand before you now today as an attorney who represents the human rights victims from Somalia, but I served for 12 years in the United States military, and I gave this kind of advice to military commanders. I can tell you comfortably that there are certain types of extrajudicial killings that come within the official scope of authority of a military commander on a battlefield. What Judge Sentell objected to in the Bellhouse case is what he called the judicial micromanagement of battlefield decision-making. And that's a decision we can live with. That's not the kind of thing you want judges going in and second-guessing. Mass killings of civilians by firing squads is an extrajudicial killing that is outside the scope of authority of any government official. The head of state, the military commander, the guy pulling the trigger, every single one of them should know that that's outside the law of nations, and that's never within the scope of authority of their job. And that's the type of allegation we have in this case. The confusion, I think, gets created by the fact that the Torture Victim Protections Act requires you to allege, in order to qualify for that statutory structure, that your individual foreign officials acted under color of law. There are certain acts that you can't do without authority. You can't commit torture for the Torture Victim Protections Act unless you're doing so under the color of law. It's not for individual criminals. It's to recognize that foreign governments and foreign officials sometimes misuse their authority. They act under color of law and they violate the law of nations. The act is not for General Yalone. It is for General Samatar. And I think that's the important distinction.
Okay. Thank you very much. I will come down to Greek Council and then go into the next case.